Yeah, okay. If you're listening at home, you just missed like the first 10 verses of chapter 15 because I forgot to turn the machine on. But it's pretty straightforward. You can handle it yourself. So Absalom sends these people out to all the tribes, basically saying, I'm about to be declared king. Okay, so this is a treasonous offense. Now he's got 200 men, but they don't know what he's about to do. It says that they went in their innocence. And it's not clear whether Absalom offered the sacrifices or a true priestly person. It was probably him. And he actually sends for one of David's closest counselors, Ahithophel, who comes, and it just grows and grows and grows. Now, David gets word, he realizes that he's in serious jeopardy. So he's got to get out of Jerusalem. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense. He's got a well-fortified city there. He has some crack troops available to him. But he realizes that mobility is key. You know, when Saul was chasing him around trying to kill him, what kept him alive was the fact that he could go from place to place to place to place, and Saul could just never catch up with him. And so fortified cities can be a big trap. If you don't, you know, believe that, have a seance and ask the soldiers at Vicksburg. They almost on the edge of panic, they gather everybody together, and he leaves 10 concubines behind, which he probably shouldn't have done. They leave, and he's got his chariothites and his pelethites, along with 600 Gittites who had been with him ever since Gath. You know, so these are really loyal soldiers. They're battle-tested. But it's a relatively small number based on what we're going to find out later that Absalom has drawn to his side. Of course, as we've discovered throughout our study of the book of Samuel, these numbers are usually exaggerated, but definitely David was undermanned here. And David says to Ittai the Gittite, you're not coming. I want you to stay here in Jerusalem, and you've not been with me very long. You came only yesterday. That's a figure of speech. He'd probably been there longer than that. But you stay back and, you know, take care of your family. I don't want you getting mixed up in any of this. Ittai makes this really strong pledge of faithfulness to David, and Ittai stays and ends up being one of the three commanders of his force. There's mourning in the country. This could have been an area that was particularly supportive of David. You can see they're weeping in verse 23. Or it could have been simply the fear that there was going to be a great agitation in the land. Rebellions are not good for anybody except for the winner. They just tear a countryside apart. David's appointed priests, Abiathar and Zadok, come with him, along with the Ark of the Covenant. And then David says, take the Ark back. And here you see his immense faith in his covenant with Yahweh. Verse 25b, if I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and the place where it stays. But if he says, I take no pleasure in you, here I am, let him do to me what seems good to him. So David realizes that he's committed some pretty egregious sins. The prophet Nathan pointed that out to him in no uncertain terms. And he's prepared to accept whatever judgment, whatever punishment God wants to put out there to him. He says, I'll call for you guys when I need you, but in the meantime, get back into Jerusalem. He goes out to the Mount of Olives, very familiar to us from the Passion narrative. He appears to be in mourning, as are the people with him. He learns that Ahithophel has gone over to Absalom, and he prays to God to basically rob Ahithophel from his wisdom and make him a bad counselor to Absalom. Which, in the end, he actually is a good counselor to Absalom. He just can't get the guy to listen to him. And he gets there to the summit of the Mount of Olives. They worship God. and an Archite, another foreigner, comes up, Hushai. David said, I don't want you with me, but here's what I want you to do. Go to Absalom, wait for him in Jerusalem, we know he's coming, and say, you know, you're the rising star and I'm hitching my wagon to you. And then what I want you to do is betray him and sort of whatever Ahithophel says, make him look stupid. So you see this interaction between human choices and human actions and the answer to prayer, because David's just prayed to God, make Ahithophel seem stupid. But then he assigns this Hushai the Archite to come in and make sure that Absalom rejects the advice of this counselor that he's stolen away. He says, you've also got Zadok and Abiathar with you. They're going to be your messenger boys, so you're going to be spying for me. And Hushai took on this exceptionally dangerous mission. So in chapter 16, he's continuing out toward the Transjordan. Ziba, who you remember is kind of the ward, but he's sort of the guardian of his ward, Mephibosheth, the descendant of Saul that David's treated very generously in order to honor his sort of pact with Jonathan. He's bringing him some supplies, and this is probably as a way of demonstrating, hey, we're still on your side, because the suspicion would have been naturally that the Saulide faction, the sort of the remaining loyalist to Saul, would have been more than happy to support Absalom in his attempt to overthrow David, not because they preferred Absalom, but because in the ensuing chaos they might have been able to put someone on the throne. Probably not Mephibosheth, because as we've discussed before, due to his feet, the fact that his nurse had dropped him and permanently damaged his feet, he would not have been seen as a viable candidate for king, because a king has to be a warrior capable of leading his people in battle, and if your feet are messed up, that's going to be tough to do. However, enough time has gone by from Mephibosheth to have had children. It's not mentioned here specifically, but you know, we've been given a sort of a timetable in terms of Absalom's reconciliation with David, and then the 4 years that passed after Absalom's return to Jerusalem. So he brings them to David, but David's a little suspicious, and so he says, so what's this? And he said, well, you know, I thought you guys might be hungry and thirsty, and you know, I brought you a few donkeys to ride. And he says, where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba said, well, he's right where you left him. He's in Jerusalem. Because he thinks that these events are going to unspool and his grandfather Saul is going to be vindicated and he's going to take over the kingship. Now, it's hard to tell whether at this point Ziba is lying to make himself look better or whether he's telling the truth. Based on what Mephibosheth has to say much later in this section, Ziba may have been lying, but we never really get to the bottom of it, and David doesn't bother to try. David keeps on going and bumps into a guy named Shammai, son of Gera. So there's all this movement, but the movement is punctuated by these conversations that he's having with these individuals. And he's getting information. He's deploying people strategically to serve as spies and messengers and as saboteurs. And so David is working very hard to help get his own prayers answered, but relying on Yahweh nonetheless the whole way. And Shammai, son of Gera, comes out and just gives him a very fine cussing. He's throwing stones, and you know, this is surprising that Shammai survives this episode. He's calling him a murderer, a scoundrel. We're not 100% sure what he's referring to. It's doubtful that he's talking about Uriah the Hittite, because that was probably kept secret. Okay. It's more likely that Shammai, as a man of Gera, was referring to the death of Saul and Jonathan and the majority of Saul's house. As you'll recall from 1 Samuel, David works very, very hard to make sure that he doesn't incur any blood guilt, because the person of the king was considered to be inviolable. And so it was a terrible, terrible sin, and one that would not put you in good stead with the people, even if they were sick of that particular king. But still, the supporters of Saul, who are left, would have seen David as someone who perhaps indirectly caused the fall of Saul and Saul and Jonathan's death, because we have to remember that, you know, in the battle where they were killed or committed suicide, depending on, you know, which version late in 1 Samuel you want to go with, David is with the Philistines. Now, he's been sent away. They don't want him in the battle because they don't trust him. But he's been with them, I think it was 1 year and 9 months, and so he was a traitor. He had gone on to the worst and most persistent of Israel's enemies. And so, you know, there's a little guilt by association there. And Shammai is saying, this is the vengeance that God's wreaking on you for what you've done. And Abishai, who's a bit on the hot-tempered side, as we've seen, you know, is ready to lop his head off. And David says, you know, let him run his mouth. Because for all we know, he's doing this because he's motivated and inspired by God. And so, you know, Absalom's after me. So all this guy is doing is giving me a good cussing, so let him be. Because it could be that God's behind this, that this is part of what I have to receive for the sins that I've committed. And then in verse 12 of chapter 16, he says, it may be that the Lord will look on my distress, and the Lord will repay me with good for this cursing of me today. And so by exercising restraint, by receiving the verbal abuse, David still has hope. His faith in God is so strong that he still has hope that maybe this somehow is part of God's plan, as humiliating and as unpleasant as it is. He lets Shammai live. So they keep on going, and Shammai actually follows along like a dog after a car. It's funny. I love the comic relief they toss in here. So Absalom, along with all the Israelites, as it says, come to Jerusalem, and Hushai the Archite comes up to Absalom and says, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" Without saying specifically which king he's talking about. And so he deceives Absalom, because Absalom, you know, believes that he is now the king. So he's sort of thinking, okay, I guess this guy's on my side now, while Hushai in his heart's going, "Long live the king, David!" Absalom actually calls him out. He says, "So this is how you treat your friend David. Why aren't you with him? You know, I can't believe, you old turncoat, that you've joined up with my side." And Hushai says, "Well, no, I mean, God chooses who he chooses to be king, and this has been confirmed by the acclamation of the people. And so, you know, I'm the one who follows the king, whomever that might be, and with him I will remain." Again, implying that he means Absalom, but he actually means David. And just as I've served your father, so I will serve you badly. Although he doesn't say that part. So Absalom asks Ahithophel, "So what's the deal?" He says, "Okay, first thing you want to do is you want to have sex with your father's concubines. Because taking over the wives and concubines of a man who's been king is, you know, a way that you demonstrate symbolically who's in charge. By doing this, it's going to fortify your popular support." So they do this, and the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the oracle of God. So not only Absalom, but also David, who had relied upon him so heavily, still sees the advice he's giving as very good. And Ahithophel continues, and he says, now, here's the plan. I'm going to take 12,000 guys. Now, this is probably an exaggerated number, but what he was probably talking about is I'm going to take a unit from each of the 12 tribes of Israel to show the unity of the entire nation behind you. And I'm going to go find David. He's got to be worn out. He's probably not thinking straight. He's probably panicked. And when I get there, they're going to be so badly outnumbered that everybody will abandon him. I'll kill David. And then everybody else, grateful for not having been slaughtered, will turn over and support you. And Absalom said, this is a good idea. You know, there doesn't have to be a lot of bloodshed. You know, just isolate David, strike him down, problem solved. But he says, you know, I want a second opinion. And so he brings in Hushai. And Hushai, he says, well, you know, I think that Ahithophel doesn't have the right bead on this thing. Because you're forgetting how tough David is. And you're forgetting how battle-hardened the men around him are. So the idea that approaching them with large numbers is going to just, you know, scare them off, you're forgetting, you know, the history of this cohort. They're pretty tough. If anything, they're going to get their backs up, and they're going to fight you more fiercely than ever. And you know, you might even send out your troops and find out that David's not even around, because as Saul learned, much to his frustration, that your dad is a sneaky sneaker. I mean, he knows more places to hide out there in the wilderness than anybody could ever possibly search. And, you know, if in the meantime some of our guys get attacked and died, then, you know, that's not going to look good for you. People are going to be going around saying there's been a slaughter among the troops who follow Absalom. And folks are going to want to wonder, you know, who is it on your side? And they're going to fear David more than they ever had before. So here's what I think you need to do. First, you need a bigger army. And so you're going to send out to all the tribes. I know you've already done it, but you're going to do it again. It's going to be like a second levy. And from Dan to Beersheba, which is just symbolic of sort of the general territorial area that was under the control of the tribes of Israel at the time. And you're going to get an enormous army. And then you're going to go out, you're going to lead it in person. And we're going to attack David and his entire army. We're going to just wipe them off the face of the earth. And if he even manages to escape and hides away in a city, then he uses this, you know, fantastical metaphor of we're going to wrap ropes around it and drag it into the sea, or drag it into the valley. And they're like kind of nodding their heads. It's like, yeah, we like this. We like this. It's very grandiose. It would appeal to a man with enough ego to try to overthrow his father. And they even attribute this to God's intervention, which, unbeknownst to them, this is an answer to David's prayer. They think, well, you know, it's a good thing that Hushai the Archite betrayed David and came along with us, because the man has some good ideas. Praise be Yahweh. Praise be Yahweh, yes, but not in the way that you think, Absalom. So Hushai immediately goes down to Zadok and Abiathar, and he says, now, so this is what happened in the council. So you got to go to David, and he says, look, you need to be on your guard, because even though Hushai's plan has been verbally affirmed, he's not sure that it will actually be carried out. Okay? People have fickle minds. They could have easily changed them and maybe decided to do both. We'll start with this guy's plan, and then if that one doesn't go off well, in the meantime, we'll have machinery in motion to get ready for what Hushai wants to do, which is going to take a lot more time. And his recommendation probably was designed to do just that, give David more time so that he can organize himself, catch a rest, and be ready when Absalom and his men finally come. So, his spies are waiting at kind of a midpoint to receive this word. He's got a servant girl who's acting as an intermediary. Gutsy women in this story helping out David. They get caught out. It's a little snitch found him and tells Absalom. And they end up being hidden. I mean, this is James Bond stuff. They have this well mouth, and what they do is they hide them in the well, They put like a covering over it, like this cloth covering, and they put grain over it so that, you know, purportedly everybody in the area will have forgotten there's a well there, and the men from Absalom who are coming by trying to find these guys won't even think to look there because they're like, oh, it's a pile of wheat, they can't be under that, move on. And unbelievably, it worked. She lies to them about their location. They can't find them naturally because they're so cleverly hidden. And then they, when they're gone, they pop out of the well, they go tell David, and they get across the Jordan. Now, Ahithophel apparently was a very sensitive man because he saw that his recommendations had been rejected. He goes home and he hangs himself. I know. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's okay. It's not the end of your career. You've got good ideas. Come on, buck up, buddy. It's just one argument you lost. You know, maybe he thought, well, this was stupid. I mean, this Absalom guy doesn't listen to me. I've picked the wrong side. We don't really know what his motives were. But he was buried in the tomb of his father, which is interesting. It appears that at this point, suicide was not considered to be a grave offense. Otherwise, he would not have received the honor of having been buried with his father. Later on, quite definitively, suicide is not considered to be an acceptable alternative, except in battle, as Saul and his armor bearer tried to do, and either succeeded or didn't, again, depending on which story you want to take at the end of 1 Samuel. So David comes to Menahem, which is sort of up in the northeastern part of Israel. Unusual place to be, really, because the northern kingdom was not always among his greatest supporters. And he sets Amasa in control of the army in the place of Joab, which is unusual because Amasa is the son of a foreigner, Ithra the Ishmaelite. And he's sort of married into the family. This is an unusual and unexplained displacement. I mean, Joab has been very loyal to David. He is a crack commander. The man knows what he's doing. This is a revelation that David was relying on foreign mercenaries. He certainly had a lot of encounters with foreigners at this point, which perhaps is to accentuate the fact that he has so lost the support of his own people. And he has Shobi of Nahash come from the Ammonites. He has Machir from Lo Debar and Barzillai, a Gilead, come, and they bring him support. They bring him all kinds of food and, you know, the type of equipment that any army needs. And that leads us into chapter 18, where you finished off last week. He divides his army into three groups. Joab gets one consolation prize. The other one goes to Abishai, and the other one to Ittai. And he's I'm going out with you. And we've seen before where he's stayed in Jerusalem while Joab's been out fighting battles. And there was an instance not long ago where Joab's about to deliver the final stroke to a city, and he says, "Come on, David, come out and join us. We want this to be your victory, so your being here is kind of important." And the guys are like, No. Don't do this, because they're really after you. You're worth more than 10,000 of us. So you just sort of stay back in the rear echelons. And surprisingly, David says, "Well, okay, if that's how you feel about it, I'll stay back." We could accuse him of cowardice, but, you know, there is some value to protecting his personhood, because if he goes down, they all go down. And before they go, David makes this plea to his three generals: "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." He's torn. He's a king who is being usurped by his son, but he is still the father of that son. And there's just an enormous amount of pathos throughout this passage. And they go out, they fight in a forest, which would have been advantageous to a smaller, more mobile force, one with greater experience. And Absalom's guys just get clobbered, absolutely clobbered. The slaughter in verse 7 is identified as 20,000 men. Again, probably another exaggeration. It was probably an order of magnitude smaller. And it says the forest claimed more victims that day than the sword. A lot of times terrain can be the real killer in battle, and certainly it's the case for Absalom, because he's riding along on his mule. He goes under the thickets of a great oak, and he gets his head caught in it. Now, you remember earlier it talks about his luxurious hair, almost this Samson-like mane of hair. And so I think the image that's trying to be conjured here is his hair is sort of tangled up, you know, which is why I keep mine high and tight, because you just never know. You just never know how it could turn out. And the guy comes to Joab and he says, you know, I saw the funniest thing. Absalom's hanging by his hair from an oak tree. And he says, Job says, why didn't you kill him? I would have given you 10 silver pieces and a belt, which is probably a sword belt. And he says, you know, even if you gave me 100 times that much, I wouldn't do it, because King said to everybody, leave him alone. If I would have killed him, then you would have probably not backed me up. You would have just hung me out to dry. And Joab said, you know, I will not waste time like this with you. He takes 3 spears, thrusts them into the heart of Absalom, and then 10 of Joab's armor bearers struck him and killed him. Now, you would have think the 3 spears into his heart would have been enough, but apparently you need more. And this might be a little bit of shading, you know. You know, Joab struck the first blows, didn't actually kill him. You might ask yourself, what difference does that make? But, you know, in the very complicated law around blood guilt, it does. Joab sounds the trumpet, concludes the battle. They toss Absalom into a pit, probably a common grave, which is an immense disgrace. But, of course, he's a traitor. He's a traitor to the true King David, at least in Joab's eyes. And this business about the pillar and everything in verse 18 is it's very unclear what they're talking about here. So moving forward, there's a guy named Ahimaaz who's really eager to take this message to a victory to the king. And because, you know, you could expect to be rewarded as a messenger if you bring good news. And if you bring bad news, quite the opposite. And Joab said, you know, I'm not sure that's a really good idea, because you don't have a uniformly positive message to offer, and there could be trouble in that. And so he points to a Cushite, who's a foreigner, and he says, why don't you tell the king what's going on? And so, again, this sort of comic relief, Ahimaaz is not going to let this go, so there's this foot race, okay? Who can get to the king first? And they went different routes, one more difficult than the other, one longer than the other, and Ahimaaz outruns the Cushite. David's hanging around, and he delivers his message to the king, and he tells them about the victory, but he lies about Absalom. He says, you know, the battle was so chaotic, I'm not honestly sure what happened to Absalom. And then the Cushite gets there, and he tells him, yeah, he's dead. And we don't really know what happens to the Cushite. It seems that David was so overwhelmed with emotion that he goes into grieving over his son. There's a wonderful anthem that was developed. I meant to bring it in to play it to you. Now I can't even remember who the composer is. Maybe I'll remember next week and we can listen to that. And he's just, his heart's been torn out. I mean, it doesn't matter how bad a child becomes, they're still your child. And Joab finds out that David's just out of his skull with grief, and he comes in and gives him a good telling off. And he says, listen, he says, I get it. He said, but this guy was your enemy. And you've had people take great risks, and you've had people take great sacrifices. And if you don't get yourself together and stop crying about this traitor, you're going to lose their support. And so what you're going to do is you're going to buck up, Buttercup, and you're going to get out there, and you're going to give them the best pep talk of all time. And if you don't, then all these people are going to leave you, and me too. So he follows his advice, and because people are, there's a lot of chatter, as you see in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 19. And David sends out some messengers, and he begins to reconsolidate his power, starting with Judah. And he takes Amasa, puts him in the place of Joab. That's a strategic move. This gives him leverage with Judah. Because remember, I mean, very recently, all these people were on Absalom's side. David's got to win them back. Because as we've seen persistently, whether it's Saul or David or Absalom, it's not just God's choice or some sort of priestly anointing. It's the popular acclaim of the people that confirms the fact that a person's become king. This process sort of rolls itself out. But in the midst of it, you see these fracture lines between the northern and southern tribes, which in 1 Kings will become the northern and southern kingdoms. So David does this with, you know, considerable difficulty, and he has to, you know, give up some stuff in order to make these compromises and reconstitute his reign. Mephibosheth in verse 24 of 19 comes back into the fore. David wants to know why he didn't support him. And he says, well, I did. I sent Ziba with donkeys and a lot of food. And, you know, I didn't come because it's hard for me to walk. And Ziba misrepresented what that was all about and took all the credit for himself. And David says, okay, I'll accept that explanation. You're not going to get all your land back, which I gave to Ziba. You're only going to get half of it, and Ziba's going to get the other half. Ziba settles for that. Barzillai, one of the supporters in the north who provided him with food, comes down. He was an old guy. He's in his 80s. At that point, 80 was not the new 60. He's quite rich, and, you know, so David wants him on his side. He's like, you know, stick around in Jerusalem with me. I want to be buddies. And he says, you know, I'm an old guy. I'd really rather die at home. I'm too old to enjoy all the pleasures of court. I'll just be a burden to you. I'll travel with you for a little while. Very humble, verse 36b, why should the king recompense me with such a reward? I didn't really do that much. But he offers up his son. David takes him. And so he's sort of making these connections. And essentially, as he did when he was preparing to overthrow Saul at the opportune moment, he's exercising diplomacy to try to get people back on his side. But the way in which he does this, you know, creates a degree of anger between Israel, the northern tribes, and Judah, the southern tribes. And you see this bursting out in chapter 20, where Shebra, son of Bichri, a Benjaminite, leads a futile revolt. He has no legitimate claim to the kingship. He sends after Amasa, the new king, the new general who has displaced Joab. Amasa is only given 3 days to assemble his army. That's not a lot of time. It says, so Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed to him. not because he was disloyal, but because he just didn't have enough time. And David unnecessarily panics. He thinks that Sheba is a bigger threat than Absalom, which is ridiculous. And so he sends Joab instead, along with the Carathites and the Pelethites and that sort of core nucleus of David's army. Sheba has to take refuge in an ancient city called Abel. And along the way, Joab comes up on Amasa and sort of tricks him and guts him and leaves him there to die in agony. Which, that's just nasty. But that's Joab for you. He's a tough customer, and he gets his job back. A woman, a wise woman, where Sheba has holed up, basically makes a deal with Joab, you know, don't destroy the city, and we'll chop his head off and toss it over the gates to you. And, Joab said, yeah, follow through with that, leave your city alone. And that is how it happened. So Joab gets his job back because he guts Amasa. And at the end of 20, starting with verse 23, you see what we've seen before. Once the kingship is reestablished in David, you sort of have a bureaucratic structure set up. And you have this division. You have this redundancy where Joab's in command of the army of Israel. Benaiah is in command of the Cherethites and the Pelethites, so you have sort of a little deck shuffling there in the cabinet. You have Adoram in charge of the forced labor, which is the first time this is mentioned. We're going to see a lot more of that in the book of the Kings. Jehoshaphat drew the short straw. He's the recorder. Sheva's the secretary, and he got Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. And Ira, the Jairite, was also David's priest. We're not 100% sure what that means. Because he's a foreigner, so how could he possibly be a priest to Yahweh? And so you have this doubling up in part so that you don't concentrate major power into a single individual. But there's also a balancing going on between rival factions. And as we move through the end of Samuel and into 1 Kings, we're going to see this sort of fissure between north and south become more and more unstable until eventually they separate, which is really the beginning of the end. So that's chapters 15 through 20 in a rather large nutshell. I'm sorry I didn't mean to go on for quite that long, but what are you seeing here that intrigues you, or what questions might you have as we sort of blown through an action-packed sequence where the action is actually done through conversations and character development? Love to see a Hollywood film producer try to do that.
I'm puzzled. Absalom had the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
And David had a bunch of foreigners.
Pretty much, yeah.
And so he defeats his own tribes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. he's willing to fight his own people to maintain his control over them. And that's not unusual. In our own Civil War, President Lincoln always emphasized that he was not fighting a foreign nation. He couldn't make that acknowledgement. He was trying to quash an armed rebellion by his own citizens, and he killed many hundreds of thousands of them in the process. Sometimes to win them back, you got to beat them first. You have to make obvious the nature of their mistake in betraying you. And after having been defeated, the Israelites, I think, probably would have interpreted his victory as the will of Yahweh. They would have been very penitent about their mistake. They were probably terrified about what sort of wrath David was going to rain down upon them, because as we've seen in previous chapters, where he's, attacking all of the tribes that border the territory of Israel. I mean, this guy's running black flag. I mean, he's killing two out of every three prisoners in one case, and he's unpredictable. He can be very bloodthirsty, and then he takes the appropriate steps to reconcile the power centers with himself, making some compromises and sacrifices along the way, and introducing new people into the leadership, trying to balance it out between North and South so that he can have a representative type of monarchy. You know, where he's trying to make sure everybody is a stakeholder. That's what he's trying to do. And he does so fairly successfully under the circumstances. So, and of course, his prayers are answered. You know, he asks that, you know, this situation be a temporary experience of punishment from Yahweh. He had hoped that it would be because of the promises that Yahweh had made to him directly. And in fact, that was the case. Caroline.
Isn't this a scenario that we see down throughout history in these kinds of conflict?
Yeah.
When you think about North Vietnam, South Korea, and South Vietnam, mm-hmm. you know, they forced labor camps, I mean, re-education centers,
yeah.
or whatever you want to call them. You take the people that are the most likely to be leaders of any other kind of rebellions and place them into places like that and
yeah.
re-educate them.
Yeah, I mean, Yahweh plays a decisive role in all of these events. But in the narrative, Yahweh is virtually hidden. I mean, you got a few prayers. But, I mean, this is a political, military situation. And you've got espionage, you've got sabotage, you know, you have all the, I mean, this is so totally typical of every power structure that's ever existed. So in a way, there's substantially nothing special going on here. Nothing special at all.
Well, as you say, it's hard to find God in it.
It is, but for the people who were authoring this and then putting together the various strands of the tradition, and then for the people who later on were reading this, the purpose of both of these books, both books of Samuel, and especially this particular passage, is to emphasize David's chosenness. That was really key. But also to expose that in the midst of that chosenness, you're dealing with a very flawed people. The story starts with his neglect of justice. And as I mentioned before, when we were talking about how the gates of the city were the location where, you know, justice would be dispensed by people delegated with that power by the king, the lack of justice, the injustice, the corruption of the courts at the gates is a predominant theme in the prophets. I mean, the reason why Israel was conquered and carted off into slavery and held captive for 70 years was because of two primary reasons, if you read the prophets, idolatry and injustice. And those two things were woven together in the minds of the prophets. And so you see the seed of that, if you will, kind of the original sin of it, here. You know, and God didn't think them having a king was a good idea in the first place. In fact, it was a violation of the covenant because only God can be their king. So you get Saul. Saul was a deeply, deeply, deeply flawed man. So then you have this rise of a guy named David. Obviously, comparatively, much, much better than Saul, but still pretty screwed up. Then you've got his son Solomon, who, again, is very ambiguous in terms of who he is and how well he performs and things like that. And then after Solomon, you know, things drop like a rock and just get worse and worse and worse and worse down through the generations until finally, you know, it's almost like two object lessons. You have this decline in the quality of the kingship. The people are made miserable, just as God predicted from the very outset through the prophet Samuel. And God lets it go on and on and on and on and on. That's object lesson number one. And then object number, lesson number two is, and just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, I'm going to send the Assyrians from the north. They're going to gobble up the 10 northern tribes. And then I'm going to let the tribes in the south around Jerusalem stew in their juices for the better part of a century and a half. Then I'm going to send the Babylonians from the east. They're going to kick your butts and cart you away. And at least you get to come back so you can keep the story of the covenant alive. Because you've probably heard about the 10 lost tribes of Israel. You've all heard about that. You've probably heard about all these crazy conspiracy theories and all this stuff. Basically, they got swallowed up and assimilated by the Assyrians. They never came back home. They never got to come back home. That's why they're called the 10 lost tribes. Yeah, David.
This whole justification of the kingship here.
Yep.
Just sounds a whole lot like the divine right of kings.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And some of them started off fine, but after a few generations,
yeah,
a few of them stayed that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, kingship has been the predominant form of sovereignty for the majority of civilization. And there are a lot of factors that are go around that. And the transition during the Enlightenment, which was really key to the emergence of democracy and other forms of more representative governance, I'm just not sure we really have time to get into all that. But, I mean, if you're going to declare yourself to be the sole and undisputed ruler over a people, you're going to want the heaviest justification you can claim for that. So you're going to say, because God said so. That's why I'm your king, because God said so. And the people kind of need that too. Because, you know, they're suffering under misrule, and they're like, you know, why do we put up with this jerk of a king? Well, because God said so. And what's the alternative? Chaos. Because, and this isn't a critique, this is just reality. The capacity for self-organization didn't exist in ancient cultures to form anything like a democracy. You see fleeting instances of it in places like Rome and ancient Greece. Okay, but it didn't live long in Greece. It didn't live long in Rome. Why? Because the greater the level of complexity, the bigger things got. You know, you can't have direct democracy like they had in Athens if more than 400 or 500 people are involved. It just doesn't work. And the same thing with Rome. The bigger the empire got, the more complicated it got, the more unwieldy it became for the Senate with its tribunes to actually rule the sucker. And so you see this gradual and then sort of gradual drift toward imperial rule. And then, you know, boom, it sort of hits a tipping point and it happens. Yeah, so.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
Kind of like, is a bad leader better than no leader?
Yes. And Augustine, 4th century North African bishop and theologian, wrote a book called City of God, which I know, Jen, you have been reading, which may have even prompted your question. What Augustine was saying, and you have to remember, he was writing near the end of the Roman Empire, the Goths and the Visigoths and all those god-awful barbarian Germanic tribes, which is part of my ancestry. They came, you know, they kept banging at the gates, banging at the gates, banging at the gates of the empire, and eventually they broke through. So in a way, Augustine's world was in the process of falling apart. He wrote The City of God. It's really sort of a theological, social, political theory that tries to explain why things are the way they are and why they need to stay that way. Because the reason the Romans fell to these northern tribes was because the corruption had become so rampant and not just political, judicial corruption, but moral corruption had just disintegrated the fabric of the empire, and it was get while the getting's good and devil take the hindmost. I mean, that was the prevalent attitude throughout society. So they were intensely vulnerable to a purposeful adversary. Despite their military advantages. And so basically what Augustine's trying to say in City of God is he's justifying the divine right of kings and the system, the status quo, because he says we deserve better than this, and God wants better than this for us. But the kingdom of God hasn't been fulfilled on this planet yet. And until it is, we're going to have to recognize that we are all imperfect beings, the wretched sinfulness of this world is a whole that's greater than the sum of its parts, and we are all part of that. God desires not anarchy and chaos, because certainly those are not circumstances within which His gospel can prevail, and therefore we've got this. And this is what we have to live with, and this is what we have to support and obey until the time of Jesus' return comes. And in the meantime, we need to work toward a better world. But we have to work within the context that we've been given by God. That's his argument, basically. I just summarized an 800-page book in about 3 minutes. And...
I don't have to finish it now.
Yeah.
Take it back to the library now.
So, see, you're done, Jim. You're done. You take it back. We've got more time than the clock on the wall indicates, because that's 5 minutes fast. We've got 10 minutes, so don't feel hurried.
I guess, Michael, I missed a few weeks.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I'm a little surprised that David had fallen to such a degree where his army and all that went to someone else.
Yeah.
What did he do? I mean, he was so popular at one point.
Well, yeah, it was a couple of things. excuse me. You have to go back to chapter 11 and David and Bathsheba,
yeah,
and his conspiracy to initially get Uriah to go to bed with his wife because she's pregnant, thanks to David, although she, I guess, had something to do with it too. And so first he tries to hide this terrible thing that he's done. That doesn't work because Uriah is a man of such great integrity. So then David sends him out to be killed in battle through this contrivance that he manufactures with the help of Joab. This Joab guy is not somebody I'd want to meet in a dark alley at night, even if we were friends. And they managed to pull this ruse off, and then this new prophet Nathan, who in chapter 12 comes out of nowhere, tells this kind of parable in which David incriminates himself, and Nathan says, you're the guy that stole this one man's sheep that it's just like his pet, and this rich guy who had more than he knew what to do with, was so greedy that he wouldn't sacrifice one of them to show somebody hospitality, and he says, and your punishment will be that the child that you and Bathsheba have born together is going to die. And David doesn't like that. He begs God to, spare the child. It doesn't happen. And then once the child dies, he sort of pulls out of his funk and he's like, well, he's dead, so what am I supposed to do now? Will I keep on bogeying? And then you have this sort of disgusting situation with Tamar and Amnon, and Amnon being killed by Absalom as vengeance and stuff like that. Well, I mean, this is just nasty. And who's in charge? Where's David in all this? I mean, how's all this going down in his own household? So So you begin to see as early as chapter 13 sort of an abrogation of responsibility. He's not willing to punish Abnon in any significant way. He doesn't do anything to help Tamar. So Absalom sort of takes things into his own hand. He kills his older brother Amnon. There's just this unraveling, this unraveling where the privileges of power corrupt, and the charge that Absalom lays against David, and there's no reason to believe that it's not true because the people rally around him as he makes it, is that justice is not being dispensed. The role of being a judge, which is embedded within the kingship that God has established, isn't being executed. And this is very disruptive to the people. I mean, imagine if the judicial system, well, our judicial system doesn't function well for a lot of different reasons, but just imagine it was gone, you know, or maybe your case is going to be heard, maybe not. Maybe you're going to get due process, maybe not. Nobody knows. Imagine living in that uncertainty. So maybe you're going to get justice, maybe not, but probably not. You know, so somebody steals your car, too bad. Somebody mugs you, and you chase the guy down, you know, and you got witnesses. You know, maybe that guy's punished, maybe not, probably not, too bad. Imagine living in that context. Okay, then imagine that multiplied over and over and over and over and over again, and the type of society that you get. Okay, and then the king, who's responsible for providing this justice, he's living large in the palace, apparently doesn't care.
Yeah.
So.
Well, at least he kind of came to his senses at the end here, right? I mean, where he's trying to get back in favor.
Yeah. Well, the hangman's noose focuses the mind like none else.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's going to lose his kingdom and his life. And he's not surprised by this. I mean, there's no indication in the narrative whatsoever that he is in the least bit surprised. Not only at what his son Absalom is doing, but the fact that he has managed to completely rob David of his popular support. There's not the slightest hint of surprise for David. And even when this guy's giving him the good cussing as he's trying to escape Jerusalem, he's like, you know, this guy might be in the right. I probably deserve this. God probably sent him to give me this good cussing. So don't chop his head off because, you know, if I sit here and endure this embarrassment and verbal abuse, maybe God will redeem me in the end. You know, that's chapter 16, verses 9 through 14, if you want to go back and reread that amusing anecdote of comic relief. I take it as comic relief, to be honest.
In verse 20, chapter 15, where he says, I do not know where I am going. He's talking
Yeah, my translation, I think yours is more to the point, Jen. Mine says, you came only yesterday. He's talking to Ittai the Gittite, which means you've not been with me long. And shall I today make you wander about with us while I go wherever I can? Go back and take your kinsfolk with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. Which is really remarkable. At this point, he needs every sword that he can. There's no indication that he owes Ittai any loyalty at all. And it's bizarre why Ittai, moving forward into verse 21, demonstrates this, you know, fight with you to the death kind of thing. And, you know, David finally accepts him and says, well, if that's the way you feel about it, then come on along. I mean, part of the genius here, because anytime you're telling a story or writing a history, and I think we're all clear that this is not history in any sense, you know, relative to what we think of as history today in the modern world. But it's so key what you keep in and what you leave out. And this is so beautifully balanced. And, you know, the temptation would have been to, you know, focus on the big fight and the blood and the gore. And but this is a sequence of encounters with real people. And the revelation of bravery and cowardice and, surprising levels of commitment from people who had no real motive to offer it. It's the humanity in the story that I think is so provocative and compelling for us, because we can all relate to it. You know, I mean,
with a touch of humility once in a while. Extremely human.
Yeah, and those are the key pivots to the passage, is that David takes this with such a measure of equanimity because he realizes that God's justice is being executed, and he's just hopeful that in the end, God will forgive and redeem him.
Does he get any better?
David?
Or does he revert to his old ways pretty rapidly?
Well, you know,
we'll find out.
We'll find out at the close. But, you know, basically, David's story is essentially done. If you just flip forward into the following chapters, it's basically the remainder of the book is poetry. David is credited with the authorship of many of the psalms that we have in Scripture. He was known as a great musician, within the first few chapters of 1 Kings, which is the continuation of the Samuel story, David dies. In fact, one of the commentators that I read suggested that when they were getting ready to go out to fight against Absalom and his forces, that one of the potential reasons why his soldiers told him to stay back was that he was just too old. That he would have been a liability on the battlefield. I mean, because he's got grown sons by now, which has to put him somewhere, you know, probably in his 50s. And 50 was old back then. It was beyond the average life expectancy of a male. Of course, within just a handful of chapters, we're going to see that he's in a pretty rough way. I mean, he rules for 40 years. He sort of comes onto the scene as a teenager, and probably comes into the kingship somewhere in the neighborhood of his early to mid-20s, you know, just guesstimate. So he rules for 40 years. He makes it to his mid-60s, and he's completely decrepit by the time he gets toward the end. Okay, now it actually is 11 o'clock. So why don't we say a quick prayer together, and off we go. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. God, we give you thanks for those who preserved these stories and have presented them to us in a way that enables us to relate with these wild adventures and our relatively ordinary lives. We give you thanks for each character in it, the bad, the good, and the indifferent. And we hope that in our lives, particularly on the broader stage of politics and economics and war, that we can see your hand guiding your purposes to fruition despite the cruelty and foolishness. And help us to pray, as David did, that your will be done despite all evidence to the contrary. And all this we ask in the name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.